Let's do this. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is cool. We've got to know each other over the last few weeks, and we started to hang out together and do some work together prior to the book coming out. And then it's been, for me, I get such vicarious kind of joy in this, and I always have done for the best part of the last 10 years of seeing people that I'm connected to, or I've done some work with, putting things out into the world and generating this momentum and this success. So it's been thrilling for me. I'm just pointing out that it's been thrilling for me. I get to do this, right? It's like, this is so cool. Look at Sarah. There she is. She's going to be on the TV yet again, talking about this incredible book. Oh, look at that. That's happening for Sarah with her incredible book. So I firstly wanted to start by thanking you for having the courage to put this book out into the world and do what you do as well, because obviously it's in a place that I have so much excitement for, the alcohol-free space, but also it's a space where it needs courageous people like yourself to show up and shine. So thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. And it makes me laugh. It makes me smile a bit because you say, oh, we've got to know each other over the last few weeks. And I'm like, yeah, but Andy, you've been in my life for about 5 years. You just didn't know that you were in my life because I think when my alcohol-free journey started back in 2017, 2018, I remember there was one day where you'd done a post in one of the Facebook groups that you were running and said, everyone share their day count. And I was on 90 days at the time, and I said 90, and you replied and went, oh, well done, Sarah. And I was like starstruck. I was like, oh my God, Andy Rummage just replied on my post. So, and then here we are today, having me on your podcast. So, how the world can change, right?
That is so cool. Do you know what? That ma has made my day, because I think that's the nice thing. And now you're experiencing that, the longevity of being involved in something that there it was, your 90 days and me cheering you on at 90 days. And now look at you. Now look at
Yeah.
what you're doing. And I think there's that lovely sort of life cycle of this alcohol-free space where people come into it in those early days and they go through their own trials and tribulations and successes and failures and all those good things. And then somewhere along that journey, I think there's that sense that you want to give back, you want to contribute, you want to share this beautiful message, this wonderful experience that we've both had. So maybe we'll begin there a little bit. If you can tell us a bit of your story that's led to this point where actually now you're contributing in such a big way for all the things that you do, and in particular the lovely book.
Yeah, thank you. So I started drinking in Manchester in the 90s, at the age of 14. And by that point, I'd been to several different schools. We'd moved around lots and lots of places. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. You go into therapy as an adult, you do all this stuff, and you go, ah, so that's what was going on for me back then. But you don't realize it at the time. But I had just made this move from this quite kind of rough around the edges high school in Scotland. And then my dad had said, we're moving to Manchester. And we went to a very kind of quite posh all girls grammar school, and the girls were playing like hockey and lacrosse at the weekend. And I'd come from this school where everyone was just smoking fags and shagging in the toilets at the weekend. And so it was just like I felt so out of place, and I had this terrible perm and this really spotty skin, and I was with all these girls that were so fit and sporty, and I just felt like a fish out of water. And you know that feeling, like looking back, it's so. I just felt tense and anxious in my tummy all the time at this school. And a year later, I got in with a group of girls that had started drinking. And I remember loving the feeling that alcohol gave me because the tense knots in my tummy, they disappeared. But also, I felt like I fitted in. I felt like, you know, when you're pissed with someone and they're like, I love you, you're my best friend. It was like, that's what I needed. I just need to get drunk with people, and then people like me, and then I make friends, and that's all that's needed. And so, as a 14-year-old, the associations I made at a very young age were alcohol is a way to making friends, to being feeling like you fit in, to getting people to like you. You know, you get that. I've had that feedback all my life. You're so fun when you're drunk. And oh, let's go and get drunk together. I love hanging out with you when you're drinking. And so that just reinforces this message that I think I had just had for nearly 30 years, was that people like to be around drunk Sarah. Sarah's fun when she's drunk, and that's the fast track way to make friends, is to go out and get pissed with them.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about that, so we tell ourselves these stories from such a young age, don't we? We have that lived experience. I was at a party just recently. It was a family event, and one of the more, I'm going to call him a cousin or a nephew effectively, was standing there with a drink. He's 17-year-old. I wasn't drinking. He noticed that I wasn't drinking. So he said, "Oh, you're not drinking." I went, "No, I don't drink." And he went, "Oh, that's boring." Which made my daughters giggle straight away because they were like, "Oh, that's funny," right? So they're all giggling. And then I went, "Oh, I haven't had a drink for 10 years. And he went, "Oh, that's really boring," right? And then some more laughter. And then he finished me off like with the knockout punch. He went, "I bet you're fun at parties." And then he just sort of walked off. It really made me laugh. It really, really made me laugh. Like, again, it was that sort of the innocence of it, but the fact that he totally did me. Like, and again, everyone thought, my girl just thought this was hilarious. But then, you know, when the dust settles, it speaks that truth, doesn't it? That from such a young age, already we're starting to program ourselves to say, not drinking is boring and drinking is fun, you know, and you've had that lived experience. I had that lived experience. And it's no wonder, you know, when we start to build these really powerful beliefs really early on, that has this huge, influence on our life as we mature into adulthood.
I did a really, and I know we're digressing, but just on that point, I did a really interesting talk the other day with a guy who is the head of, he leads the way in Australia for the research into teens and alcohol. And he was saying by the age of 2, a toddler can tell whether a parent's drink is alcoholic or not, and can tell in what situation an alcoholic drink would be present. So from the age of 2, we are starting to, and for me, growing up in a house, my parents, they didn't have problematic drinking, but they partied a lot. We had a lot of dinner parties. We had a lot of Scottish drunk men wandering around my house in kilts, like looking for the bathroom and very pissed. And so even as a little girl, without me realizing it, I would have been taking on this subconscious messaging that alcohol is what parents do when they see their friends.
Yeah, it's incredible. And we'll come back to the story in a second, but just to keep expanding on that, you know, you still see it in our mass media. You know, I watched just recently The Morning Show on Apple, yeah, which I love that show. Ted Lasso, love that show. But if you look at both of those shows, when they're not actually working, i.e. Ted Lasso, they're not on the football pitch, they're drinking. On The Morning Show, when they're not actually delivering the show, they're drinking. Like every single scene, it's incredibly hard to find a scene in either of those massive successful shows when they're not drinking. So again, it's just this constant barrage, isn't it? Not only are we picking it up from being a toddler, we're having a lived experience very often as a really young person. And then culturally, we still in this day and age, we're getting absolutely smashed by this subliminal messaging that, oh, to be romantic, you need alcohol, to have fun, you need alcohol, to be unbelievably successful, to be like those beautiful people, those wonderful characters that we love on the screen. And alcohol, I mean, it still is, it's quite mind-boggling when you get outside and you look back in, as we both get to do now. I'm often got my hands on my face thinking, what are we doing? Like, how have we ended up in this place? Well, I think I know how.
Yeah, totally, totally. So young Sarah had that messaging for a very long time. So it was no surprise really that alcohol, you know, became so present in my life. And then fast forward, it was university. We know what university in the UK is like. And then I moved straight to London and I got a job working in recruitment in the city. And so I was doing banking recruitment, where my fourth job interview was going to the pub to do shots of tequila and Sambuca to see how well I could handle my booze.
Yep.
And that was in 1998. So again, you're laughing. You will know exactly what London in the city was like back in those days, right? And so working in recruitment, you are just whining and dining. I was doing front office recruitment. I was out with traders, risk heads of risk and all of that, just whining and dining these clients that you would think nothing of going and starting drinking at lunchtime and finishing at 1-2 in the morning, getting up and doing it again the next day. And I felt like my life up until that point had probably prepped me pretty well for this job. And so again, but even looking back then, my drinking wasn't problematic. No one was saying, oh, there's a problem with your drinking. I drank when other people were drinking. I didn't really get hangovers. I was very, very high tolerance for my alcohol. And so there was no real question marks for me. I do remember one manager saying to me, we want to make you a manager, but you do get very drunk on the company nights out. And I was like, what the company nights out where you ply us with free champagne in order for us to get drunk, but I get too drunk. Like, what's the amount that I should be
Yeah.
drinking here that is okay, right? And I'm sure you can relate to that as well.
Completely. Yeah. And having spent most of my sort of life, my working career in that world, although that's starting to shift now, which is really interesting. But yeah, I know exactly how that feels. And say my interview was over a couple of bottles of wine, and it didn't seem to have any relation to my actual experience. It was more, could I have a drink? Could I handle myself in that situation? Was I fun to be around? And again, those things tear at me a little bit because I think in many ways, had I not been drinking, that opportunity might not come my way in truth. Had I turned up, said I don't drink in that scenario, that would have been a straight red card. I think I wouldn't have gone no further in that career. And that's been a career that has served me well in so many ways. But equally, I always have to comfort myself with the fact that, firstly, that's not in my story. But even if it was, other opportunities would have opened up that maybe would never have opened up if I was drinking, if you know what I mean. So I think we can't go back and erase the past. But it's interesting, like and it's still to this day, this is not some antiquated thing that was going on that's completely transformed. Much of those industries are still very like that. It is changing, but there's still a huge drinking culture there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so for me, the drinking probably changed. I met my husband and we got married and had a baby, and he's from New Zealand. And so we decided to move to Australia. And I think I underestimated how hard that was going to be to leave behind a very successful career, a very close-knit group of friends that I'd had for such a long time. Making my own money, all of those things that was my life in London, that was, weekends in New York and nights out in fancy restaurants, and all of a sudden we were on the other side of the world. I got pregnant again very quickly, so we suddenly had two kids under two, no friends. I was making friends, but they weren't people that had known me for a long time. Gus was out working very long hours setting up a business, so I was on my own at home all day with two very demanding young children, pureeing carrots, going to baby rhyme time, cleaning up baby sick, going out trying to make friends, but not knowing how to make friends because I'd only ever been able to make friends with alcohol before, because that was my chat up line, was, do you want to come and let's go out to the pub and get pissed? And all these other new mums who were sat there breastfeeding were going, well, why would we want to go out and get pissed? But I didn't know any other way to make friends because that's what I'd done since I was
Yeah.
14, right? And so I was really lonely. I was really sad. I was really homesick. But I felt like I shouldn't feel that way because on paper I had everything. We were living in Australia by the beach. The sun was shining. I didn't have to work. We had enough money saved that my husband, could work and I could be at home with the kids. But I was so sad, and alcohol became a way to make those feelings go away. And this coincides as well with, this was 2011 after Scarlett was born, and mummy wine time was really starting to become a thing. The direct marketing to mums of mum needs wine and I wine, so mum drinks wine, and all of this marketing that was starting to come out. And so in your mind, even though you might be thinking, I shouldn't be doing this, you're going, oh no, it's fine. Like, everyone does it. This is the norm. Everyone is just, using wine to cope with being a parent. So you find ways to justify it. And it wasn't like I wasn't drinking to the point where I, was drinking in the morning or anything at that point. And as you and I have talked before, that's often more problematic because you think you don't have a problem because you're not starting at 10 in the morning. And it was always after Gus had got home at night. And it was always, I was still able to get up in the morning. I was still able to do everything I needed to do. It was just always doing it, feeling a bit shit. And just feeling a bit shit became the underlying theme of how I felt for years and years without really. And the only time I didn't feel a bit shit was when I was drinking. So therefore, you create this more cycle that drinking is fun because the rest of the time you feel a bit shit. And so that was just this cycle that just went on for years.
Yeah, and I think so many people get caught in various traps when it comes to alcohol, but I think that is the classic where it slowly degrades the quality of your life in terms of your energy, in terms of your vibrancy, in terms of your health, your wellness. And the only time you seem to feel a bit better is when you drink. I mean, if you think about the ultimate trap that you could create for a human, I think it's alcohol. I really believe that. I think it's one of these substances that causes many, many issues, from anxiety to low mood to poor performance. And it seems to be the solution to the very things that it creates. So it catches us in that loop, doesn't it? Again, whether it's around socializing or whether it's around relaxing, whether it's around escaping, we just get caught in that loop. It's the confidence. We get confidence when we drink, but it's the very thing that takes away our confidence, and we get caught in that loop. Yeah. I mean, think about what a trap. If you were to design a trap for humans and then mass market it and make sure almost every human on the planet is caught in that trap, and I think that's sort of what's going on, isn't it? So you're it in that is. Space. You're in, you know, in Australia. And I think as well, what's also important to acknowledge, like, we are humans at the end of the day. And when we're in pain, we will look to something to soothe that pain. And I think, again, this is the strange thing about alcohol, because it's mass marketed to us. It's everywhere. Everyone does it. It's this really easy go-to soother of that pain. So therefore, I think it's only natural very often. Gabor Maté talks about that a lot, doesn't he? Not why the problem, why the pain. That at certain points in our life, you found yourself, you know, lonely, even though you was your lovely husband and family. It's still lonely, isn't it, when you're making new friends and you're away from home? It's probably very natural that we just ease our way into that space. And then again, that's the only time that we feel a bit more connected. And there's another trap that begins itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And that trap was me for years. And by this point, you know, the kids are growing up. I'd set up my own recruitment business. I, you know, made friends. But alcohol was still very, very present. I remember as I got into my 40s, noticing the impact it was having physically more and more. So, and I talk so much about this in the book, is about why, as women are aging, you know, we do find that those hangovers will start to get so much worse and the hormonal changes. And I went to my GP and I had anxiety, like terrible anxiety. I've never had anxiety in my life. And I said, you know, I'm just don't know what to do with myself. I'm overthinking everything. I'm scared about everything. Sometimes I take the kids to school and I just go back and get into bed all day and I don't want to get out. And at no point did the question of alcohol come up, ever, never, never, never. But then happily gave me a script for anti-anxiety tablets and said, go and take these. This will, you know, that you'll be okay. You'll just need these for a little while. I didn't take them, but I did have this underlying feeling that there was, by this point, the little whispers had been there about my drinking and I'd been pushing them down, pushing them down. And then a couple of things happened that were my equivalent of the rock bottom moments of, there was a fall at a party where I smashed my face and, you know, the humiliation that came with that. There was a Sunday morning getting woken up at 7:30 in the morning by my son at the end of my bed in his cricket gear going, "Mom, it's time to go to cricket." And I'd been on a 14-hour champagne session the night before and I'd got home at 2 a.m. My husband was already out fishing, so he couldn't take him. And I knew I was still over the limit. I knew I couldn't drive my son to the thing that he loves most in the world because his mum was still pissed on Sunday morning. And that, one of my core values is family. And when, you know, you get that feeling of I'm letting him down, I'm letting everyone down. And it was after that that I decided to do a 21-day break. And I was like, 21 days. They say that's what it takes to change a habit. I'll be fine. I'll do 21 days.
The minimum you can possibly do. Let's just minimum. Like 21. Right. That'd be enough.
I think what I'd read was that 21 days is what it takes to detox the liver. And that was in my head, was I just need to detox the liver. But I got to the end of the 21 days and I was like, oh my God, like, this is how it is to not have anxiety every day, to not be tired all the time, to feel positive. And so I kept going, got to 100 days. And then was, you know, the fading effect bias, everyone saying, when are you drinking again? And thinking, because I hadn't done the reading, I didn't know the stuff, thinking, oh, well, I'll be able to moderate now. I clearly don't have a problem because I've just done 100 days. That was a nice little reset. I've lost some weight. I feel good. Now I'll be a normal, healthy, moderate drinker and everything will be fine. And that first night I went out and I had a glass of wine and I was like, look at me go. I'm just someone that has one glass every now and then. And within a couple of weeks, it was right back to where it was before. And that continued. Sorry.
And that is just, it's so interesting, isn't it? We see that all the time with people that you think you can go back and moderate. And then very quickly, those well-worn habitual pathways are there. And we just plonk ourselves back into our normal social life. Nothing really changes in that regard. And then, of course, you know, for the first, and that was my story, for the first week or two, I could really manage it, and it'd go, oh, this is great. Look, I am literally having one glass. I'm a bit of a superhero. And then, of course, tired, stressed, emotional. The one became two, became five. And then it was right back to where we were. It was just, you know, gloves off. So I totally resonate with that.
Totally. And so then I went back to drinking. And then the following year, I did another 100 days. And that was when I found you and joined the 1 year no beer groups. That was 2018 and got to my 100 days and then did a trip to the UK and was like, oh, I can't go and see all my girlfriends in the UK and not drink. We were doing a trip to the south of France, just us girls. So I drank and that led to continuous, very heavy drinking for another year. And then April 2019, I just knew that I was done. I actually set the date in the March and I set the date and I went, I'm going to stop on that date in April and that will be my last drink. And I just knew because I had the evidence now. I had the evidence that said everything in my life is better when I don't drink. I'm happier. I'm a better mom. I don't have anxiety. I sleep. In that 3 months that I took off in 2018, I made more money through my business than I made the entire year before, because when you're motivated and you're doing your sales calls and you're following up all the things like you, that I was in a commission only job, right? And so I was really focused and on it. And so everything in my life I realized was better when I didn't drink. So I set the date in the March and it was the day after a friend's 40th. And I went to that 40th thinking, this will be my last hurrah. I'll go out and get absolutely smashed. And I had two drinks, went home. And then that was it. I was just so done and so ready. So next month will be my half decade, five years.
Yay. That was so cool to hear. And I think that is, again, indicative of many people's stories, that it's not this instant, or I made a decision and then da-da. And I think a lot of people fall into that trap that come into the alcohol-free space and they see someone like yourself that's on 5 years or myself that's on 10 years and fall into the trap of thinking, oh, they must have sort of had it a bit easy. They probably have got cast iron willpower that I don't have. And they made a decision and then da-da, there they are 10 years later. But the truth is, your story is like my story. There was years behind that moment, that last drink of starting, stopping, longer breaks, smaller breaks, getting it wrong, getting it right. And then eventually you build the evidence. And I think really what happens is you change the beliefs inside your mind. And that's a lot of what I, you know, really do now as a coach in training people, is trying to train them to help people change their beliefs, because ultimately it is a beliefs game, isn't it? Those beliefs that we carried from our teens, and you articulate that through your story into your adulthood in the world of recruitment, builds this massive like litany, this powerful case for alcohol is good. And then at some point we need to unpick that and go, actually, is that true for us anymore? And then through that lived experience, we realize over time, no, it's not. And you did it brilliantly. It's like everything in my life was better without drinking. And there's that penny drop moment of, so why the bloody hell do I keep drinking? It's just pointless. I'm just not going to do that thing anymore. You set your date, it's done. Yeah. Good on you. 5 years. That's pretty cool. So what's been happening in that 5 years? What happened next that's led to this, you know, almost towards the end of that 5 years, this beautiful book that we have?
So that was 2019, then 2020 COVID hit and my recruitment business went on hold. I was doing legal recruitment at the time and no law firms were doing any recruitment. No one knew what was going to be happening in the world. So I thought, well, now is the perfect time to retrain, because I knew that I was done with recruitment and that, you know, as many people do when they quit drinking, they go on a path of wanting to help others. So I then retrained to be a health and wellness coach and a grey area drinking coach. And then I set up my business in early 2021. And then in March 2021, I was interviewed in a very big online women's Australian health website. And I shared my story, like I've just shared with you. And I told them about grey area drinking. And I shared how I was drinking, the impact it was having, that I wasn't an alcoholic, but that I knew it was time for me to stop. And at this point, I was just coming up to my 2 years. The story went live and 8,000 women contacted me within 24 hours.
Wow.
And I mean, every single one said, you've just told my story.
Yeah. I mean, that is so beautiful to hear. And I spend so much time talking about this, even with the coaches that I train. It's like, all you ever need is a story, because that's what people resonate with. You know, they don't necessarily want lists of stats and facts. They just want to hear a story. And we've all got our story. And when we share our story, it talks to people a little bit like us. And that's why the more people that can be courageous enough, most emotional listening to that, to go out there and share their story. Like, imagine 8,000 women were sitting there thinking, it's just me, I'm the only one. And then you come along and are courageous enough to share that. And they're like, oh, it's not just me. I'm not the only one. Like, what a wonderful thing to have done. Wow.
I remember when the editor of the website sent me a copy of the story and I read it and I was like, oh no, we can't do that. I was like, no. Like, that's way too raw. That's way too detailed. My kids' teachers might read it. I can't have that go out into the world. And I remember she said to me, but Sarah, think about how much this might impact people. So I was so nervous, but then I'm just so glad that I did that, because as a result of that, I have changed thousands of lives through simply sharing my story. And then being able to share with people, we've all been sold a very good story about alcohol, and maybe that was your story in your 20s, but maybe it's not your story in your 40s, and you are allowed to change your mind and you are allowed to be a different person now. And that has been, you know, the crux of what I do now as a coach, is working mostly with midlife women who are at that point where they're using alcohol for all the reasons that I was: boredom, stress, loneliness, to give confidence, you know, all of those things, and show them how to remove the alcohol and still have a great life. And that was why I brought out this book, was because I wanted to write a book that was not about how to get sober, because there's brilliant books out there about how to get sober. It's a book about how do I create a life so I don't want or need alcohol anymore.
Yeah, and this is so powerful. And that's why I resonate so much with the book in many ways. And it always reminds me of this lovely saying by Carl Jung, Swiss psychiatrist. And it's this: what was once a great truth in the morning of our lives, by the afternoon would have become a lie. And I think that's so true of many people's relationship with alcohol in our teens and 20s and whatnot. It definitely appeared to serve us in some way. And then we get into the middle part of our life, or the latter part of our life, and it's no longer serving us in the way that it did. It's become this thing that actually is a trap that's degrading our life. And it's lovely to hear you share that a very similar way, because I think that's what resonates with so many people. It's that wake-up call of, just because it was true at one point in your life doesn't make it true for the rest of your life. And what was once the truth can become a lie as we mature. And coming onto the book now, which I love, exactly that. So it's less of a how-to, and there are lots of hows to. It's very much about inspiring people, isn't it? I think to a bit, again, very similar to my messaging, to show up and shine without alcohol. So maybe take us through some of the sections of the book. There's one bit in particular that I'm quite interested in, which is the sober love side of things. And I'll tell you why I'm interested in that, because I was asked a question around dating recently on a really big podcast and I totally fumbled it. I didn't really come up with a very good answer. I was a bit stuck, and the question was very much along the lines of, you know, what about the classic dinner date? How do I do the classic dinner date and not drink? And again, that's not something I particularly have experience of. So anyway, if we can focus on that, but maybe if you can give us a bit of an overview of the book and some of the key points.
Yeah. So I've kind of gone into the sections that I wanted to explain, and I've written the book. A lot of men are reading the book actually and telling me how much they're getting from it. But the woman, as I was writing the book, it was and is a midlife woman who is at that point where she's not dependent on alcohol, but she's using it as that crutch. And so I've broken it down into, let's understand the physical and actually how we can start to remove the physical cravings for alcohol, because a lot of my coach training, which I did with Jolene Park in the States, has focused on repairing the nervous system, looking at our neurotransmitter levels. Many women are deficient in GABA, which is a result of menopause and age and everything like that. And GABA is our natural neurotransmitter that helps us feel calm. And so if we are deficient in it, we are so much more likely to crave alcohol, because alcohol works on the GABA receptors in the brain to give us a surge of GABA. So one of the ways that we can really start to support ourselves to crave alcohol less is to find ways to increase our GABA without alcohol. And so I talk quite a lot in the book about serotonin, dopamine, GABA, the why we need to focus on our sleep, why exercise is important, and really going into that physical side before I've then gone into the emotional side.
Can you talk to me about GABA? and how to increase that. Because actually it's quite interesting. Professor David Nutt, who wrote Drink, I'm sure if you've read Drink, but he's created this drink at the moment. I think it's called Satantia, that actually, I'm due to speak to him soon, but removes the acetaldehyde, the cancer-causing carcinogen, and actually just still has a positive influence on GABA, on the neurotransmitter GABA, which I think is quite interesting. But I'd be interested, for those listening, how do you increase GABA naturally?
So nutrition-wise, there are certain foods that will help us. And so the number one thing is gut health. So we create GABA in the gut. So if we have really poor gut health, we are not going to be able, and the same with serotonin, 90% of serotonin is made in the gut. So fermented foods, to all the things that we know about gut health are so important, reducing sugar and processed foods so that we've got a place where we can actually create our GABA and our serotonin. And then there are certain foods that are particularly good for GABA. So almonds, broccoli, bananas, oats, halibut, and beef liver. So I keep thinking about my mum's liver and bacon casserole when I say that. And I'm like, what?
I was smiling though, because I love broccoli, oats, almonds. I mean, they're in my, pretty much every single day. What were the other ones?
Halibut, the fish.
Yeah.
Almonds, bananas, broccoli, oats,
that was it.
Halibut.
And then beef liver. Yeah. That's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. So those are the foods. And then there's certain foods for serotonin and dopamine, which is very much based around the amino acids found in proteins. And then in terms of supplements, people that do, a lot of the women I work with have a very dysregulated nervous system. And we work on certain supplements that will help produce increased GABA, one of which is L-theanine. And in the book, actually, I've listed a test, an online test that your listeners can go and do called the Braverman test, which you do online. It's $19.99. You get a really detailed report and it will tell you what your deficiencies are. So you can see straight away, what am I deficient in? And I do that when I work one-on-one with clients, and I do it in my groups as well. So it's called the BravermanTest.net. And it's really useful to do that. So supplements, rhodiola, ashwagandha, L-theanine are very good for GABA. And then lifestyle. So one meditation can increase GABA by 27%. So mindful activities, when we're in those flow activities, cooking, reading, drawing, colouring, dancing, singing, we are increasing our GABA levels.
Wow. That is wonderful, because I've been involved in this a long while now, and GABA is something that I'm always talking about in terms of how alcohol stimulates GABA, that gives us this sort of almost Valium-like relaxed feeling, and it comes alongside its partner in crime, as it were, glutamate, which excites the system. GABA slows the system down, glutamate excites the system, and therefore we often get that kickback the day after, as GABA is sort of flushed out the system or back to normal levels faster than glutamate, which leaves us sort of misbalanced in the terms of that anxiety and that fear and that beer fear. But actually talking about GABA and stimulating that organically and healthily is a wonderful conversation. I wasn't aware of that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got the physical side of the book. I've started the book with my story, but also really asking the reader to start thinking about why they drink and what they get from alcohol, because, you know, as you and I both talk so much about, alcohol is not the solution. Alcohol is not the problem. Alcohol is the solution to the underlying problem. So what's the problem we're trying to fix with our alcohol use? Is it stress? Is it loneliness? Is it anxiety? Like, whatever it is, and getting to the root cause. And then the remaining chapters are very focused on sober socializing. I've got a section on stress and how we manage stress. I've got a section on how do we have fun without alcohol. I've got a section on finding your purpose and your values and creating that really meaningful, rich, fulfilling life for you as the person you are at this age and stage and season of your life that is going to bring you the most joy. And then there is the chapter on relationships, sober sex, dating, everything like that, because what I find so much, the question I get asked, and I run alcohol-free programs all the time with hundreds of women, and the number one issue is, what do I do when my partner still drinks? Because so many women are in relationships, I was, with someone who drinks at the same level that they do. And Gus and I mean, my chat line to him when I was 24 in a backpacking bar in rural Western Australia was, he was the tour guide on a tour I was doing up the west coast of Australia. And my chat up line was, hey, do you want to come and play my drinking game? So that kind of set the tone for our marriage and our relationship and what that was like. So when I stopped drinking and he was still drinking, our relationship massively changed. Because I think that when you stop drinking as well, you end up going on a bit of a journey of self-discovery. Because I think, I would say, what, 70, 80% of people that quit drinking end up going down this path of reading podcasts, learning, and just going, oh my God, all this stuff, I want to know more. And then our partner is still there watching the footy, drinking beer, and doing what you used to do with him. And it's causing this massive divide. And so I've dedicated a whole chapter in the book to this topic.
And how is that going for you? Because I'm in a similar situation. My wife still drinks. And I think the truth is, most people that decide to take a break from alcohol or quit or whatever it looks like will be in exactly the same situation. I think it's quite rare to see a couple that both stop at the same time. It tends to be one person. And I think that's because our relationship with alcohol is totally unique to us, isn't it? It's our story of past history and experiences that leads us to that point of thinking, actually, this is not serving me anymore. But your partner has got a completely different relationship with alcohol, and it's their story and their history, which might not mirror or match yours. Therefore, I think very often in most couples, there is that divide. One stops and the other continues to drink. You know, I'm 10 years into this. So me and Tara have been married longer now with me not drinking than we have when we were. And like you and your husband, we were thick as thieves in terms of us being drinking partners and drinking buddies. And it's settled into a nice rhythm now. Tara's got her friends that she likes to go out with, and they're all good friends of mine as well. But they like to have a drink, and then I just let Tara go and do that. That's her thing. Off she goes. She doesn't expect me to come along. I don't have to, like, you know, be there by her side in those moments. It's like, right, you go and have fun. If that's how you want to have fun, go for it. I'm going to go and do something different, or I'll see you off. You know, I'll bail out at 10 o'clock at night, and sometimes she'll rock home at 2 in the morning or whatever it is, right? And then I'm fine with that. I'm up and out the next day, but I can see that it's having still an impact on her. But it's balanced out beautifully for us, and we've got kids then, have had those two role models, and it works really well. And actually, funny enough, Tara's just taken another break today, so she's starting on another, you know, she does 45 day breaks quite regularly. So her relationship with alcohol is definitely changing along with mine. But how do you find like that yourself?
So we ended up in couples therapy, which was absolutely amazing for us, because there was a lot of stuff that had just been brushed under the carpet for years and years. And then you just drink and kind of just, you know, forget about it. And so that was super helpful. One of the things I always promised myself was that I would never tell Gus what to do, and I would never tell him not to drink, because it wasn't ever my place to do that. But interestingly, him watching me meant that he ended up giving up drinking, because he just saw the difference in me. So he stopped for 3 years, and he was the classic. He did what many of us don't do, which is he decided on that day, I'm never going to drink again, and just stopped. And that was it. No, like going back to it and all the rest of it, until it got to 3 years. And then he went, yeah, if I need to actually, you know, stay off this forever. I was sat there going, oh my God, here we go. Right. He's going to go back to drinking. Yeah. And he did. And it was so funny, because he said to me, he doesn't let me talk about what I do. You know, like, you can't coach your husband. Right. And so he always used to talk about his mate. So his mate would be like the little, I call her the wine witch, but for Gus, it was his mate that sat on his shoulder when he started drinking, and would be like, go on, have another one. Go on. Oh, you're really funny now. Come on, keep drinking. And he went, I can't believe it. I haven't had a drink for 3 years, and my mate was right back there again.
Still there, like, yeah.
Oh yeah, he don't go anywhere. So he dabbled, he tried moderation, he did all of that, which was his journey, and then he stopped again.
Oh wow, all right, so you both don't drink now.
Yeah,
I do wonder whether at some point that will happen for me and Tara. I don't know, it's the truth of it. We'll see how she gets on this little adventure, but I think there's definitely a slow progression towards it. But I always tell this story. It makes me laugh. I think your partners have to be ready. You know, I've never, ever told Tara what to do. And it sounds like you haven't done the same. And I think that's the best approach. What we can do is show up and shine, live our life you know, through this change and this adventure. And I think that inspires so many people. But Tara, again, did another break about 2.5 years ago. And she was doing this exercise program, which meant she didn't drink. She got about 45 days in, looked amazing, lost a load of weight, feeling incredible, pulls me to one side as if she's telling me this great secret. And it's like, you know, I'm 45 days alcohol free. I've got more time, got more energy. I look better. My skin's better. I'm looking at her going, are you having a laugh? I've been banging on about this for the last 10 years. And you're telling me like it's a secret. I'm on social media every single day telling everyone about that stuff. And now you're like giving me the secret. Oh, yeah. It's classic yeah. Tara move. But yeah, but my point is that goes to show that, you know, people need to be ready when they're ready to change.
Totally. And I say this all the time, but in the book, I do take people through like a 6-step process of, you know, what we can do to make it less difficult if our partner is still drinking, and what I've seen works really well with other couples, and, you know, setting those boundaries. Are you going to have drinks in the house, or, you know, can he put his drinks in another fridge so that every time you open the fridge to get some milk to make a cup of tea, you're not facing a cold bottle of white wine that was your, you know, chosen drink. So setting those boundaries, talking about it as well. Like at the first time I took a break, I was really ashamed that I had reached the point where I had to take a break. So I didn't tell anyone, oh, I'm worried about my drinking. It's been impacting my mental health. I went to the doctor about my anxiety. I didn't say any of that. I went, oh, I just want to lose a bit of weight. So when you say that to people, their response is, well, first of all, they think they can twist your arm. So they really try loads because you haven't been truthful. But secondly, they don't support you because they don't know how hard it has been for you. Yeah. And I always say, I wish I'd been so honest that first time, because I know that the support would have been very different. But I didn't, I just felt so ashamed. I felt so ashamed that I'd reached a point where I had to take a break, that I just glossed over it and pretended it was that I just wanted to lose weight.
Yeah, and I think that is actually a really interesting point, that we do have that sense of, I've blown it. You know, I've had my hand in the sweetie jar for too long, and now I've got to like almost punish myself. I can't be like everyone else. And I understand that. And I think for that reason, we often come up with those, I'm going to say, weak excuses early on, because we just don't quite have that confidence. And I think that's a really nice point to make, that actually by being really honest at the start, everyone around you knows then. And I think also that's what happens. Lots of people then are in their own mind when people are twisting their arm, getting frustrated or potentially resentful about their partners or friends or colleagues or whatever it is, because they don't understand. But how can they ever understand? One, because they're not you, and two, you've probably not given them the true story anyway. So they're rolling around thinking, you just want to lose some weight, but you look great anyway. So I don't care if you need to lose weight. Let's have a drink together.
Yeah.
I haven't realized that actually what's gone on is this real anxiety, this, you know, degradation of mental well-being and mental health. So I think that's a really important point to highlight. And I think this couples piece that we're talking about here is really, really important. It, as you say, it comes up all the time. And I think something else just to highlight is that it is a solo mission, this alcohol-free thing at times. And we're all in relationships, whether it be friends or family or, you know, romantic relationships or whatever it is. But it, I have to tell people all the time, it is your choice. It's not your partner's choice. It's your choice. You know, and you also can't expect at times loved ones and friends and family to completely change their way of behavior for you. So you really have to drill it into, this is your mission. And if this is important to you, you've got to show up and shine that message rather than expecting the whole world to bend to your new behavior. And I also think that's why groups and communities are really important. And actually, even though you might not get that support naturally from a loved one, because they just don't get it, they just don't understand it, they can't see it, even if you tell them what it's about, people still can't quite get it because they're looking it through their map of the world. I think having a community online, and that's what's been beautiful about the last few years in the alcohol-free world and the sober space, is really important. So you've got a space where you can go to and share a struggle or a success, and people get you. Like, you know, like we shared at the start, I got to cheer you on. Do you know what I mean? There might have been people in your family being like, yeah, whatever. Whereas I was like, go on, get in there, girl.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think that's really important. And on that note, actually, talk about your groups and communities. I know we're still on the book, but I just want to make sure we don't miss that as well.
Yeah, so I've got a large free Facebook community called the Women's Wellbeing Collective, and that's got about 17,000 women in it from all over the world, mostly with midlife, who are all on this journey of wanting to just live their best lives. So that's a brilliant community. And then I run alcohol-free challenges for women 4 times a year, which are focused on midlife women and really bringing in speakers. You know, you've been a wonderful speaker. We talk about you all the time, with coming in to bring different ideas. And I have a menopause expert come in. I had someone come in who talks, you know, very much about women exercising at this age and what we need to be doing. And so it's very focused on midlife women and all of the things that we need to add into our life if we're taking alcohol out. But on your point then, I was just going to say about the couples and the relationships as well, is it's really important, I think, at some stage that we say to our partner, how is it for you, me not drinking? Because we can get very focused on ourselves, but it's actually really hard. Like I've seen many times where when I've encouraged a client to do that with her partner, when she said, oh, he's really withdrawn and he's really this, that, and the other, and I said, go and ask him how it is. And when she's done that, he has said, I'm really scared that you're changing and I'm going to lose you and I'm not going to be enough for you anymore. And that, and so allowing for that space as well, because fear can often manifest as anger and it can manifest as disinterest and it can, you know, be, it can be really showing in different ways. But underneath it, a partner might just actually be really scared that they're watching us change and evolve and go on this journey of self-discovery, and they might feel a bit like they're being left behind.
That is a wonderful point, because I think that's what we see really with the whole social pressure around drinking. I think it is people are fearful that if you're in their network as a friend, as a colleague, as a family member, as a, you know, as a romantic partner, that actually your evolution, your change is going to mean change for them. And people hate change. We're so scared of change in general. But if someone changes in your network, it starts to change a dynamic, doesn't it? And there's also that fear around the fact that if they're evolving and going on this journey and you're not with them, is that going to mean a change in your relationship? So that creates fear. And I think what often happens then, and we've all been guilty of this at probably at some point in our life, people want to keep you doing and still partaking in those old behaviors, because then the change is over. So I think that almost motivates them even more to try and derail your best laid plans, as it were, whether that's your friends in the pub or like, go on, have a drink with me, because they don't want to, you know, you to be shining that light around them to a loved one who's a bit like withdrawn and sullen, because actually they just want you to drink because it's putting them under pressure, which is creating a sense of fear. I think that is a really important point, something I don't highlight enough. So I thank you for that, that actually, whilst it is very much a solo mission, there is a great question to be asked of your partner, like, how do you feel about this? So that maybe there is some reassurance that can go around that, that whilst I'm going on this journey, it's great for me, which is going to be great for you as well, as opposed to, you know, I'm going somewhere completely different.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. I'm a bit conscious of time. I know we've covered lots today. So in terms of the book, how would you summarize it so that if people are listening to this, and I'm sure many people will, that they'll go out, grab a copy, connect with you? How would you sort of bring it all together?
Yeah. So the book, I've written this book for people who have been sober for a little while, maybe, or are sober curious and are going on that sober journey, and they want to rediscover who they might be at this stage of their life. So it's all full of everything. I've been on such a growth journey over the last 5 years, well, 7 years really, that I've been on this journey for. And it's everything in there that I've learned that has helped me. There's a whole chapter on stress and all the tools that have really helped me to manage my very dysregulated nervous system so that I'm not ending each day at 5 o'clock, frantic, overwhelmed, adrenaline coursing through the body, desperate for a drink. So there's so many tools, and so many women are just emailing me every day just saying, this book is life-changing because it combines not just lived experience, but also so many practical tools and takeaways. And then it's got a checklist at the end of each chapter, just summarizing, this is what you can do if this is what you're struggling with at the moment. So I just hope it's a book that every woman will read at some point in her life and be able to refer back to, with so many tools and strategies to help.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. And it's called Beyond Booze. So do check it out. And how else can people find out about you, connect with you?
So Instagram, I'm present, Sarah Rusbach. I'm on LinkedIn, Sarah Rusbach. My website has got all the details of the programs that I run. I run menopause programs, I run women's nutrition programs, and then I run my alcohol-free programs as well.
Wonderful. Sarah, I'm so proud of everything you're doing. I'm so thrilled that I've been a little part of the story along the way. Keep showing up and shining your light. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.